Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome, Squawker Talker listeners, and welcome back to the Squawker Talker. I'm your host, Greg Johnson, and you join us on a momentous week in football around the world, especially in Europe. It's the return of the Champions League, and joining me to pick this apart, this knot of football to pieces, is Nick English. How are you doing, Nick?
Hello, how's it going?
It's all right. Hello. Hello. Very good intro. And Ollie Young-Miles is here. How are you doing, Ollie?
Hello.
Hello.
Very well.
Ooh. So on to business. I mean, how the week went, the week was the Champions League. So we'll get straight to it. Spurs 3, Dortmund 1, I'd say of all the kind of British fixtures, this is probably the one that maybe, you know, has not has the most riding on it, but it seemed to me the most complete performance, the one that maybe signals the most for the campaign going forward. Kane on the double with two great goals after a very special Son goal of his own, basically just destroying Dortmund's right flank. But that was levelled by Yarmolenko's screamer as well, which needed those two Harry Kane goals. Only good goals scored at Wembley on this one, Ollie.
Yeah, it was a bit of a strange game. Dortmund dominated the ball for large parts.
I think he had 60% possession.
Yeah, I was just looking there, actually. Spurs have had 58% possession in the Premier League, which is the third highest in the league. But yeah, yesterday Dortmund completely dominated that side of the game, especially in the first half. But Spurs showed, you know, they can win in other ways. Usually in the league, they wear teams down through passing it around the box and intricate movement. But against Dortmund, they countered them. First two goals came from counter-attacks, especially the first one. And the third one as well was, you know, sort of Spurs just breaking really quickly and you know, sucker punching Dortmund effectively. But yeah, it was great for Spurs to finally get that Wembley win.
We're so used to seeing Spurs dominate games and not win. So to see them get dominated, not totally, but slightly, and then be really clinical on the break, that should be a warning sign for loads of teams. They basically did to Dortmund what Chelsea did to them in the FA Cup semi-final last year. It was really efficient performance.
I mean, the thing was, Dortmund had 60% possession, as we said, but they only created six chances. I think two of those came from corners, whereas Spurs had 40% and created 11 chances. So they obviously used the ball resourcefully, despite not really having as much of it as they usually do.
Well, I mean, it's such a contrast to the performances you saw from them in Europe and at Wembley last season. Has the Wembley curse been lifted, Nick?
Yes. After the game, Jake Humphrey was saying, "That's it. We're not allowed to talk about the hoodoo anymore." And while it was a bit, you know, hackneyed.
But what about the voodoo?
Yeah. Well, what about the voodoo, Ray? A guy called Gerald. No, the thing is that while that's a bit cliched to say that, it's absolutely true. It's just you know, they really needed this win. It's one of those weird things where, whether it's psychological or not, they needed the win. And what's interesting about the win is that they actually massively used the pitch to their advantage.
Yeah.
Dortmund play on a slightly smaller pitch than Wembley. And Wembley, as we all know, we've spoken about loads of times, is a massive pitch. And Spurs really used that to their advantage. Pochettino obviously picked Son very much with using that space in mind. He was probably pushed into it by the fact that Dele Alli was still suspended. But yeah, very, very clever setup and a really, really good performance.
But Ollie, I mean, you've looked at this a lot over the last year, that's fair to say. What do you think the curse amounted to, really? Was it the wrong formation? We saw him line up with a back three against Dortmund. They often played 4-2-3-1 last season before they kind of brought that in the Arsenal game. Was it the wrong player selection from last season compared to now? There was a very strong team that Pochettino put out. Or is, as Nick said, was it a psychological factor which they've now overcome?
I think it was a mixture of things. I think there was a clear mental block for certain players at Wembley. But I also think the probably bigger reason for that was, you know, they couldn't play their pressing game at Wembley as they could at White Hart Lane. White Hart Lane is so much smaller that, you know, when Spurs could press in twos and threes. At Wembley, the pitch is so, so big.
It's exhausting to do that.
Yeah, they can't do that for 90 minutes. And I think that's where they really struggled. But yesterday, the difference was they were happy to let Dortmund have the ball, which meant that they could conserve their energy and then counter them. So they found a different way around it. The issue for them, I think, will be, you know, in the league, there aren't many teams that will dominate Spurs. So they won't be able to counter as they did last night. So there's still that sort of issue. But I think the fact that they showed that there is another way that they can win is clearly a big positive from last night.
Just before we go more into the guts of this fixture, Mr. Walker Porter has asked a question on Twitter. Where does Harry Kane now rank in the top forwards in football at this very minute?
Well, this morning we were talking about how one of our former employees, Ibi Akas, doesn't even rate him in the top 10, which is completely bonkers.
I mean, he now works for the police. Someone should arrest him for that.
I mean, it's hard to see in terms of... If you're talking about central number nines, I don't think there's many better, to be honest. He's on a par with everyone. If you look at his goal scoring rate and what he also provides to the team...
I was going to say, it's not just about the goals either, is it? We even saw it last night.
Yesterday was as complete a number nine performance you could hope to see. He was holding the ball up. His link-up play was fantastic. He was running channels. When he was brought off, he looked like he was going to explode. He was so tired. But he didn't look like he wanted to come off. I think Pochettino brought on Llorente just to be like, well, I actually still need you for the weekend. Yeah. We've got the win here.
Well, we were talking about this earlier. Because they've got the Carabao Cup coming up next week, I actually think Kane will start the weekend as well. And he'll get his rest in midweek when they'll bring Llorente and someone in then.
Yeah, he will definitely. He's one of him and Eriksen are basically guaranteed starting every single week. Since Poch has taken charge, really, they've always played. And yeah, I mean, they can't drop him. He's so important. And, you know, it's September now. He's got four goals in two games now.
Exactly.
So he's flying.
There's 100%. One player that is going to be missing when we return to the Champions League with Spurs is going to be Jan Vertonghen. There was a bit of confusion about this. Did he get a straight red or a second yellow card? I think it was actually a second yellow card going off what UEFA have said on their website. He was a bit unlucky. He threw his elbow out, but he kind of seemed to lose his balance a bit, so it wasn't quite like a strike. But he caught Mario Götze, who definitely made a bit of a meal of it.
Ridiculous decision.
But he got a second yellow, so he's going to be suspended for the next game as far as we know. Is this a worry, with Wanyama coming back into the team, hopefully be fit by then, you'll be able to maybe move Dier back, and then Sanchez's form means that maybe he's not going to miss too much against a side like Apoel?
Well, that's the thing. That's the saving grace from Spurs' point of view, is that it wasn't a straight red, so it's going to be a one-game ban, and that's away to Apoel, which is huge. If Vertonghen got a three-match ban, he's out of both Real Madrid games, which is massive.
Yeah.
I mean, he's so important. Since Kevin Wimmer's left, he doesn't have a backup as that left-sided centre-back role. Mm. So losing him would be absolutely huge. And he's one of the most experienced players as well.
But then I guess if you really are stuck, Ben Davies has played that role for Wales as well.
He's playing so well as a left wing-back that you lose something there if you push him back as well. So
you want to keep that back three as stable as possible. They've been so good. Vertonghen was unbelievable yesterday.
Arguably the best player on the pitch.
Him or Kane, probably the best player on the pitch. I mean, he was spectacularly good.
Yeah. Taking a moment to appreciate.
to appreciate Jan Vertonghen.
Yeah.
He's in his prime.
Why wouldn't we? But two players that... I mean, I said I did the five things after the game for Squawker. And I thought Davinson Sanchez and Serge Aurier looked like they've been playing for Spurs for 2 years.
Yeah, they were brilliant.
Didn't look out of place at all. Very impressive.
Yeah, well, I thought Aurier would come in because... Although he hadn't played for Spurs yet, it was the kind of game that was perfectly suited to him. He's got so much experience in the Champions League. And also he's so powerful and physical and strong and technically very, very good that he can dominate that flank.
He's exactly Pochettino, the kind of footballer we were saying that Kieran Trippier isn't.
Yeah, exactly. Trippier is, he's pretty much a one-trick pony. His one-trick is very good. His crossing is great.
Yeah.
But I think he's looking at it. I think he will probably play against... mid-table Premier League sides, and Aurier will play in the big games because he's just a far more well-rounded footballer. And he came in, and as you said, he slotted in seamlessly. He had so many nice touches, and he was just so aware and composed on the ball as well. So, yeah, it was a really big positive for Spurs then.
And talking about the Wembley pitch, just the way he was adding that width down the right was absolutely spectacular. But the Wembley pitch wasn't the only thing that held Dortmund back. They were missing nine players through injury. There was a bit of talk before the game, was this the right time for Spurs to play Dortmund? I think the match, even though Spurs were impressive, kind of proved it was. Didn't it, really? As you say, they didn't create too much from open play, but there was still those chances from Aubameyang and Pulisic. Do you think Spurs got off a little bit lucky by the timing of this one?
Slightly, but even then, Dortmund's squad is very deep, and they had a lot of good players on the pitch. Aubameyang, Pulisic was outstanding, I thought, as well. They've got a very good squad, Dortmund. And a few weeks ago, Spurs were playing Chelsea, and everyone said this is the best time to play Chelsea because they had a really depleted squad and they won. So, look, Spurs did what they had to do, and it was a huge, huge result, because I think ultimately in this group, Real will top it, Apoel will finish bottom, and whoever comes out on top between Spurs and Dortmund will get second. So it was a massive, massive win.
As I say, Real are the favourites. Obviously, they're two-time now reigning champions and consecutive winners, first times in the Champions League era. But does Spurs have any chance of topping this group, Nick?
I think they do, actually. I think Real are so good, especially in knockout rounds, that I don't think they'll be particularly fussed if they come second. I think that they'll try and draw the away games against Spurs and Dortmund. I think that's the approach they'll take, and if they can manage to win one, then they'll go for it. Mm. Batter Apoel home and away. That is put your house on that. And then at home, they'll probably try and squeeze out wins against Spurs and Dortmund. But I don't think they'll be too concerned if they come second, because in knockout stages, I mean, nobody wants to face them. So there is an opportunity here for Spurs. And I mean, going back to Dortmund being injured, Dortmund played really, really well in that first half. I mean, that sort of performance, that quality of play, is probably enough to blow away most teams in European football. And Spurs, like, held strong, and they did a very good job defensively, Alderweireld and Vertonghen especially. So
they kind of held them at arm's length a bit, didn't they, really?
They had to. Yeah. Dortmund were playing brilliantly. I mean, they were so high up the pitch. They were making all sorts of channel runs. Pulisic was all over Davinson Sanchez for about 15 minutes. So,
but I think, as Ollie said, it was almost... Well, that's true. It was really impressive how, like, Sanchez and
Alderweireld. So if they can replicate that sort of form, batten down the hatches, then... You know, they're in a good position in case Real Madrid slip up.
I mean, no disrespect to Swansea, but they're the side that face Spurs this weekend. Should be a much more simple task for them, really, especially with Paul Clement still trying to figure out how he's going to work Renato Sanchez in and all his other new bits to the team. Ben Davis could have not a homecoming, because it's going to be at Wembley, but against his former club, could be another nice, nice weekend for Ben Davis, who was very impressive last weekend. Moving on now to another British fixture in the Champions League, and that's Chelsea's 6-0 win over Karabag. A proper, proper rout. Goals from Pedro, Zappa Costa. I mean, that one was a bit of a cross that went in, but still very, very nice to see. Azpilicueta, Bakayoko, Batshuayi, and he could have had a second goal as well, but that was actually awarded as an own goal in the end. Atletico and Roma played out a 0-0 draw in the other game in the group to hand Chelsea the top spot. I mean, such a convincing performance that it almost kind of feels irrelevant. It's just one of those dead rubber games where, as you said, with Real Madrid like swatting away the minnows, it's not really much you can draw from these kind of games, is there?
Well, no, because it's the sort of game where you expect a big win for Chelsea, and they've done exactly that. It's always the case that a lot of big teams turn up to these games and they don't play 100%, and then they sort of sneak a late win. Chelsea were just incredibly professional. They played to 100% and they got a 6-0 win against a team that's nowhere near being in their class. And tactically, Conte got it spot on. So very efficient performance.
Mm. But as you said earlier, Chelsea have been impressive this season against stronger opposition, such as against Spurs at Wembley. Against Arsenal this weekend. Rather than talking about the Karabag fixture, it feels more relevant to look ahead to the weekend, really. Is this the perfect warm-up to face the Gunners?
Yeah, 100%, because they had... I mean, imagine if Chelsea had Roma or Atletico. You know, that's a much more trying fixture ahead of a big London derby. Conte was able to rest players. He's found out more about his squad players, like Zappa Costa and
Batshuayi. Didn't have to start Hazard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So,
and he got a nice 30-minute run out as well.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the perfect start for Chelsea, really, because, you know, if they had an away game at the Calderon, for instance, not the Calderon, the new one.
The Wanda Metropolitano.
Yeah, the Wanda.
Then that's a much, much trickier game. But they've got 3 points, an emphatic win, and they've been able to rest players.
Massive
so
goal
perfect.
Difference as well. Mm. And Atletico is such a defensive side that kind of a big win can make a big difference.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Something we covered on the Defending the Numbers podcast, if you haven't heard already, do check out on Deezer and on iTunes and give it a lovely big 5-star review if you can. This week, one of the talking points was Bakayoko and Kante's performance against Leicester City last weekend, when they got 100% tackles won and 100% take-ons completed. As they covered in that podcast, last time Arsenal came up against a side of midfielders capable of winning all their take-ons, it was Liverpool. It was Wijnaldum. He got 8 out of 8, and Liverpool won 4-0. This is going to be a bit of a problem for Arsenal, isn't it, up against Bakayoko and Kante?
I mean, it's so predictable, it's almost tragic. Because Wenger's announced that Xhaka and Ramsey aren't going to play in midfield. It's going to be, I think, probably Wilshere and Willock, potentially, or Wilshere and Elneny. So it's going to be Xhaka and Ramsey. He's not going to play a 3-man midfield. He's not going to do it. And
once he gets his formation, his head, he doesn't move from it, does
yeah,
he?
Yeah, so man for man, that midfield's going to... It's going to be a painful afternoon. Mm. Like, they're not going to be able to dominate that midfield, Jack and Ramsey. And when they don't dominate the midfield, the defence is left incredibly exposed. And guess who's about and ready to score goals? It's Eden Hazard.
It's Alvaro Morata.
Yeah, guess who's really good in the air? It's Alvaro Morata. Yeah. This is painfully predictable. This is one of those games that everyone can see it coming from a mile away. The only way you can counteract Bakayoko and Kante, get them chasing shadows, three-man midfield. He did it in the FA Cup final for the first half of Wenger. It worked beautifully. Do it again.
Mm-hmm. Looking the other way, is there anything Arsenal can do to threaten Chelsea? I mean, they've got some weapons. Kolasinac looks very good on the left. Lacazette is a great finisher up front. Ozil on his day can pull the strings, and Alexis Sanchez could be back in the fold for this one, and he's, you know, he's going to have to put in a performance if he's not going to suffer boos for the rest of the season. People say he doesn't care, isn't he, really? Is there anything you see in Chelsea that Arsenal could try and exploit?
It's a tricky one, because...
Pick on Fabregas? Is that the only thing they can do?
I think, as Nick touched upon, though, the midfield battle is where it's going to be won and lost, and if Arsenal go like for like and have two midfielders up against Chelsea. Chelsea could even have three, actually, if they put Fabregas in there as well, as they have done in the league. Then it's going to be really difficult for Arsenal to get anything. And you're looking at Chelsea, I don't think they've really clicked into top gear yet, and they've quietly gone about...
They're just humming, aren't they?
Just winning like they did last year. Mm. You know, they've won three in a row since that Burnley game in the league. So it's going to be difficult for Arsenal. I think they've got too many players out of form at the moment, and the system's not quite clicking for them. But, I mean, you never know. You never know that.
So you're saying there aren't any Chelsea weaknesses to exploit then?
it's difficult to see at the moment.
There are, because Wenger already exposed them in the FA Cup final last season quite gratuitously for everyone to see. You need to play really quickly in midfield. You need to have a lot of bodies there to bypass their pressing in midfield, especially Kante.
I mean, no disrespect to Wenger's game plan, because it did work, but I do think in that FA Cup final, Chelsea did seem to take their foot off the pedal a little bit as well, which definitely played into Arsenal's hands.
Potentially, but they had far more rest than Arsenal had, and they had a total cruise to the title, which Arsenal were desperately clawing for fourth place. So, you know, there's for several ways of looking at that.
I mean, they're going to have more rest this weekend as well, because Arsenal are in action Thursday night, tonight, against FC Cologne from Germany. And as we've seen, they're currently wandering down Wardour Street, making a lovely racket with all their fans, with some flares, megaphones, banners, all the rest of it. How should Arsenal approach this tonight in the Europa League? They are playing at home, they're not travelling away, so that does cut down on some of the issues of playing Thursday night football ahead of the weekend. What do you reckon, Nick?
Well, toughest team in the group, Köln. Arsenal are pretty much guaranteed to win every other game. If they don't, then, oh boy.
How many times have you said that every Champions League?
Yeah. Well, in terms of Köln, they're not an amazing team.
They lost their biggest weapon the summer as well, didn't they?
Yeah, exactly. So there's not a lot about them. They're exactly what you'd expect from a sort of higher mid-table German team. Very well organised, very well coached. They've got surprising amount of pace and physicality, but Arsenal have the weapons to cause them a lot of problems. Giroud starting tonight, I mean, that's just a nightmare for a Köln defence that aren't exactly that well-renowned.
Liverpool are another side with lots of firepower, but also one with some problems at the back, as we now know and as we talk about every single week, pretty much. What maybe should have been a comfortable win, really, at home against Sevilla, was kind of undone by their own kind of, you know, madcap antics at the back, really. It finished 2-2. Roberto Firmino missed a penalty. Same old defensive frailties kind of left them exposed. Well, we'll say exposed. Their defence exploded upon itself, didn't it? And a very unhappy Jurgen Klopp, both during the match and at full-time, kind of, you know, let his frustrations get the better of him, let's say. Errors from Matip, Lovren, Joe Gomez, who also saw red as well. It seems that no one is safe or without fault at the moment in Liverpool's defence. And I saw there was a stat going around that I think they only actually let on two shots against Sevilla, but obviously both of those were tucked away for goals, I believe. We've heard a lot about how they're doing better than we expect because they're minimising shots faced. I think a lot of people said that last season as well, but does that stat actually mean anything if the shots that do get through just cause so much damage, Ollie?
No, it means absolutely nothing.
That's a definitive answer there, guys.
They still drew the game. They threw away the points, really. I think Liverpool had 24 shots in total, Sevilla 7. And, you know, Sevilla managed to sneak away with a point, which is massive because they're probably Liverpool's biggest rivals, you say, in the group.
And they had their own issues as well. They weren't exactly fours.
No,
they've had an awful game.
They've struggled post San Paoli. But, I mean, those names that you read out, Matip, Lovren, Gomez, I think you know, when we're talking about Spurs finding another way to win, you know, they were able to counterattack because they can rely on a really solid back four, you know, defensive unit. Whereas Liverpool, I mean, if they're not scoring, then they're going to, you know, they're going to concede every game. They're so one-dimensional in that their attack is very, very dangerous. But defensively, they're just not good enough. They needed to sign players in the summer and they didn't.
Well, on that point, Coutinho did come on, I think, for the first time since the kind of Barcelona saga was put on hold by the close of the transfer window. Let's say he starts playing more regularly. If him and guys like Salah and Mane can play together, adding more quality to this attack, will that be enough to give the Reds a sort of deterrent to make their defensive issues less of an issue?
Not if you attack in the exact same way every time, which is what we saw on occasion last season. If a team has figured out how to defend against your system, bringing on someone who's an even better version of Lallana or Wijnaldum, who can shoot from long range, that might unlock it some of the time, but it's not going to fundamentally change the perception of the game. Liverpool have conceded 13 goals in 7 games this season. Jurgen Klopp just needs to figure out how to minimise that to a goal a game rather than 2 goals a game right now. That's the priority for Liverpool.
This weekend they're going to face Burnley, a side that, well, exactly the sort of side and the one that kind of embodied their problems last season against smaller opposition in the Premier League. They set up with 2 banks of 4, very hard to break down, and they actually beat them away at Turf Moor as well. They're going to be without Mane because of his boot to the face against Edison. So Salah and Coutinho are going to be needed as well, but do you see anything in Dominic Solanke or Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain could give them this like second gear, this different way of attacking that could help them out here? That's a no.
I really like Solanke, but Firmino's actually playing quite well. His penalty miss aside last night, he's playing that role perfectly, really.
I think we saw in pre-season, Klopp actually used him quite an interesting way. He would play Firmino up front still, but play Solanke almost in the hole behind him.
Yeah.
It was like our favourite word, a shadow striker. do you see anything, any kind of tricks he could bring out to really like kind of unsettle Burnley?
I think the obvious one will be to bring Coutinho in and put him in that left wing slot and keep Salah out on the right without unsettling it too much. I mean, that front three could break down Burnley, although they've had a really impressive start to the season that's kind of gone unnoticed.
Although Tom Heaton, the hero of every single top six last season, is injured, and I think Dyche is going out for a few months, isn't he?
Liverpool haven't got their best finisher in Sadio Mane. He's their most clinical player. All respect to Firmino, who's an amazing hold-up player.
We saw with Salah against Man City, the amount of times he got on goal and they just like shot at the keeper.
Yeah, he's not quite there, whether he's rusty or whatever, we don't know, but you've lost your most efficient goal scorer, and it's really going to be one of those situations where Liverpool, they're going to get an early chance. In the first 20 minutes, they need to tuck it away. And without Mane, who's that going to fall to? They really need someone to put the ball in the back of the net early.
Well, it does need to be Salah because he is the other kind of rapid guy on out wide to come inside and attack. We've had a question, kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier about defensive issues. Gaz Tuport asks, and I'll caveat this by saying I do know this wonderful listener who provided the question is a Manchester United fan, so bear that in mind. Do Liverpool's problems under Klopp undermine the years of attacks that Jose Mourinho has suffered for ensuring that his sides are primarily defensively solid?
Yeah, in a way, I think it does, because if you think of pretty much every title-winning team, they're built upon a solid defence. You know, no team that is very good going forward but terrible at the back wins anything. If you think of Brendan Rodgers' Liverpool, pretty much similar to this side. Tottenham under Harry Redknapp, similar to this side. Very entertaining, great to watch, didn't win anything. And I think Liverpool under Klopp are pretty much in that mould, really. You know, they're a great side. They've got very good attacking players. But defensively, they're not good enough. And Mourinho, you know, for all his faults in terms of getting teams to play attractive football at times, you know, he knows how to set up a side to be difficult to beat, and that is what wins trophies ultimately.
They're almost like two ends of the same spectrum, aren't they?
To a certain degree, yeah, but I don't think Klopp's Dortmund were ever this leaky when they were at their peak.
No, they had Sven Bender as like their kind of like DM guy covering the back four. And it seems that Klopp has thought, well, I don't need one of them. I'll just get a passer in. Well, he thinks he's a passer in Jordan Henderson and make space for a more positive player high up the pitch. But it seems to
I don't even think that that's the issue. It's just every time it's individual mistakes. Like the ball slips under someone or there's a missed kick or something. Like, you just needed a more decisive, better centre-back in the summer and you didn't get it. He came out yesterday and said, oh, if there was one problem who'd have solved all our defensive issues, we'd have spent all the money on him. It's like, well, you tried to, but you went about it. You went about it wrong and you got found out with Virgil van Dijk. So now
he's starting to kind of trip over his own quotes from the past as well a bit, is Klopp. Which is a bit bit annoying, really, because, I mean, we've seen how much certain fans of certain fan bases enjoy pointing out the contradictions of other managers. And he's a very likeable guy, but it's a bit, you know, it's a bit frustrating to see such a...
He has really odd excuses, Klopp. Mm. I've never seen a manager with such odd excuses, but there's nothing wrong with that. He just needs his defenders to stop making stupid mistakes. Yeah. I don't know whether that comes from him or from them, but yeah. It's been happening for so long now. They'd have won so many more games if they weren't making these mistakes.
We do have to remember, though, his record against top six opposition is actually really good. Like he's we say, oh, he's got all these problems.
But you know, you need to beat the small teams to win anything.
There's no medal for having the best record against the top six.
Mourinho,
you just get a graphic on Sky Sports News. That's it.
Or on Squawker. Follow us on Twitter.
Yeah, exactly.
Mourinho's record against top six is really good. Yeah. He beats the little teams as well. Another thing on Liverpool as well, I find a bit strange is the goalkeeper situation at the moment. I'm not sure who's the number one.
What is that about?
I mean, he just keeps sort of, you know, changing them game by game without really sticking to one.
He brought Karius in against Arsenal, and Karius almost cost them three goals by dallying on the ball when Danny Welbeck's in front of you. Danny Welbeck is the best person at pressing goalkeepers probably in Europe. Don't dally on the ball. Like, what is... Just solve your goalkeeper
situation.
Mignolet's
actually been quite good as well.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a weird one. I'm not sure exactly what he's trying to achieve by rotating his keepers.
We talked a bit about Jose Mourinho and Jurgen Klopp. We're going to move on now to Manchester United 3, Basel 0. Lukaku got the goal, yet provided so much more as well, as we're going to come on to shortly. Mkhitaryan again popping up with a bit of quality with the pass. And Fellaini came off the bench to replace the injured Paul Pogba and make his height count by scoring the opener. But obviously the injury to Paul Pogba is the kind of big talking point, especially going into the weekend against Everton. He pulled up with a muscle injury, could be out for at least this weekend, maybe more. Mourinho didn't look very happy with him coming off, clearly, because he's a very important player. Can United tick without him? And if so, how?
It's going to be very difficult for them because he's so unique. I think it was last week we were talking about the most complete midfielders, and he's, I think, by far probably the Premier League's most in terms of his technical attributes and physical attributes rolled into one. He's got everything really that you want from a complete central midfield player, and they don't really have anyone like him. Matic is very, very good at what he does. Herrera's a good player as well, but they're going to really miss Pogba because he knits everything together, really. And it looks like a hamstring, which could be 3 or 4 weeks. So
they're saying up to six. To 6 weeks, which would be a huge miss.
Well, you don't want to rush him back because he's so important. But there is a weird contradiction in football sometimes when you have these extremely complete players. Because they're so complete and they can do everything, in some ways they can almost not make their sides predictable, but they can become so important and so able to do everything that you take them out and suddenly you realise it's not so much a team, it's more built around this one guy. And that, maybe that's something United have to deal with now.
Maybe, yeah, but last season it was Herrera who was their all-purpose midfielder. Just Pogba's become a much better version of Herrera and offers a lot more, especially going forward. I don't know if you've seen that compilation of Herrera taking long shots on Twitter doing the rounds. It's crazy. He can't shoot for toffee. One thing that I noticed was against Stoke, Pogba started in the 10 and Mourinho obviously wanted to try bringing Herrera back in, and they did not look in control of that game at any point with Herrera. Maybe,
just redundancy in the middle.
Yeah, maybe like he's a bit... Yeah. Herrera's a very capable deputy for Paul Pogba, don't get me wrong, but that is a big miss.
By the looks of it, the deputy is Fellaini because he's who came on to replace him directly. Do you think that's actually going to work against Everton, though? Because if you look at them, you've got guys like Phil Jagielka, Michael Keane, Ashley Williams. They're going to gobble up those crosses, surely.
Yeah, but I think United's thing against Everton this weekend, it might not be a bad game without Pogba because you can hurt Everton out wide, I think. Spurs demonstrated that last week when Ben Davis created about a million chances. They've got no pace out wide, and without Coleman and players like that, their backups aren't really particularly good either. So I think if United exploit them out wide with Mkhitaryan, Rashford, Martial, then they might be able to cope without Pogba this weekend.
And we did see how good both Martial and Mkhitaryan and Rashford have been last two games at just kind of beating their man out wide and taking it forward, especially Mkhitaryan against Basel. He was doing some ridiculous tricks and skills and all the rest of it. But another player in United's attack who is the focus of a question sent in from Jash Visaraj asks if we can talk about Lukaku and his perceived lack of, quotation marks, intelligence and his general play outside the box. So there was some pass map going around, I think sent by quite a well-known kind of Arsenal fan account last night, kind of laughing at Pogba. He's got no passes going to. But if you actually watched the game, it was like his off-the-ball movement, which really kind of seemed to bring everybody else into play, even if he wasn't actually involved with the passing. Did you watch the match yourself, Nick?
Yeah, Lukaku's hold-up play was fantastic against Basel. That's exactly what you want.
The way he pulled wide as well, he just opened up the box for people to come in.
You want... He's... he's not a target man, a classic target man, but he has the physique of target man, and he has the ability to take players with him. Mm. That's exactly what he was doing. He was getting the ball sort of in like a centralish area on the edge of the box and just going wide with it into the space and then hooking it back. And what does that do? That drags all the players over, opens up space for the left winger, and allows Mkhitaryan, you know, all the other tricky players that they have to work their magic. It was really good. It was really, really good play.
I mean, we've seen Lukaku do amazing things from out wide a few times in England as well. That game against Chelsea thing in the FA Cup where he collected the ball on the left wing and basically just dribbled through using all of his attributes and just levered it in. Talking about your points on Everton's weaknesses at fullback and other areas, could this be another game where Lukaku shows his ability outside the box as well?
Yeah, I think he's one of the better strikers, I think, outside the box, especially when he turns players and runs on goal.
I mean, his take-on stats are actually really, really decent.
Yeah, he's so quick and strong, but like his close control is really good as well, which no one really gives him credit for.
It's all the first touch banter, isn't it? So.
Yeah, I know, but this intelligence thing is such a nonsense. You don't score that many goals at his age if you're not an intelligent striker. Yeah. I mean, he's not the kind of guy that scores 5, 6, 7 goals a season from outside the area. He gets a lot inside the area, which shows that he's in the right place at the right time, so he's a clever player. It's good to see how he's linking with the wide players as well. Another sign that he's kind of in sync with what Mourinho wants him to do. Against Everton, I can see him having a good day, to be honest.
Another player who kind of passed the test, if there was a test to pass, was Victor Lindelof, who had a very good game against Basel. He's kind of been kept out of the pressure of the Premier League because I think he's going through what Mourinho has called in the past the Mkhitaryan process of kind of adaptation to the English game. But like Chelsea's win against Karabag, was this a bit of a nothing result?
Well, this is exactly the game that Victor Lindelof is used to playing. He's used to having hours on the ball so he can pick his pass, pressing high up the pitch, no real pressure. So he looked totally comfortable. This is totally unsurprising. The real test for Lindelof is when he comes up against a really top-quality striker and a team that presses high up the pitch and doesn't allow him to pick his pretty pass for 10 seconds.
His pretty pass. We had a question through on this whole idea of some games being worth more than others and the one-sided nature of some of these group stage fixtures. Basel obviously dominate the Swiss Super League. They are basically like the Bayern Munich of Switzerland, and they weren't really up to much against Man United, it's fair to say. Karabag lead inside in Azerbaijan, and Manchester City, as we're going to come on to very shortly, thrashed Feyenoord in Rotterdam. So on that note, the football hipster asks, is the gap between the big teams and the smaller teams in the Champions League threatening to undermine the very competition?
It is a tough one because you don't want to see teams getting spanked 6-0 in the group stages. It's tough because the gap between teams in the top five leagues and the rest is so big now that, you know, the teams in smaller leagues just won't be able to compete. But at the same time, they need the revenue from playing in the Champions League as well. So it's difficult. I don't think you can really change that sort of system. I think UEFA are trying to make it easier for big clubs to qualify, but obviously they have the seeding system at the moment, which sees the winners of the smaller leagues go up against each other to qualify, which is how Karabag are in there and Celtic are in there in the first place. It does undermine the competition a little bit, but you need these teams in there. They deserve the the sort of spotlight for winning their own leagues. Otherwise, what's the point in them even bothering?
Absolutely. I mean, it does come down to finances, and then it comes down to the tactical things of if you are Basel in Switzerland, you can play like Bayern Munich, whereas in Europe you suddenly have to become West Brom. But on the finances of it, it's not really a meritocracy, is it? Because the money you will get for being an English club in the in the Champions League will be higher because the value of your TV audience is higher. Yeah, so it's nothing to do with the actual quality of the team or your achievements. So there's no way this could ever be fair, is it?
No, of course. Of course not.
Is there any way we can fix this?
Probably not.
No.
Not with the current like footballing governance bodies that we have in place.
Because why would any of the top five leagues vote against having their leagues
exactly
enriched more than
others? Why would any of the Premier League teams vote to change anything about the Premier League? Like, it makes no sense. But just on that point, I think ask the question again at the end of the Champions League group stage, because it's only one round. You know, yes, a couple of teams got absolutely tonked, but to be fair, Karabag and Apoel are the worst of the minnows in this. Cyprus and Azerbaijan.
I mean, Apoel, they only lost 3-0 to Real Madrid.
Well, yeah, exactly. Real Madrid. I didn't watch the game, but from what I hear, Real Madrid barely got out of second gear. So,
well, Cristiano Ronaldo hasn't been playing, so he's like, "I'm fresh. Why don't you come on, score a penalty, score a goal."
Let's see again after six rounds of fixtures if we're still saying that there's a massive gap between the big teams and the small teams. That's
so. Hey, that listeners, Nick is saying once up to speed, Apo on Carabag will run away with the Champions League this year. But moving on now to Feyenoord 0, Manchester City 4. John Stones on the double. He's now joint top scorer in the competition with Harry Kane, Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo. What do you make of that?
There you go.
Well,
he really is a ball-playing centre-back,
every dog has its day. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but talking about fixtures that don't really matter. I mean, this does matter to Man City in the sense that Napoli lost to Shakhtar Donetsk away in the other fixture 2-1. So it's a very interesting group, which City just look like they're just going to dominate, aren't they, really?
Well, yeah, especially after Shakhtar's result against Napoli. We've all been tipping Napoli to do big things this year. They still might, obviously. You know, Shakhtar away is a pretty difficult opening game.
It's just a weird
game.
Result because, obviously, it's not even Donetsk now. It's just a weird place to go.
Yeah, and Shakhtar, you know, have decent players that can hurt you. I think Napoli just had an off day, but City should win this group. Winning 4-0 against Feyenoord, you'd expect them to beat Feyenoord, but that is an impressive scoreline. Yeah. It's an intimidating place to go.
I mean, look how Manchester United have struggled away in Holland in recent years.
Yeah, and they started so quick as well.
Yeah, by all accounts, Feyenoord had a really bad day at the office here. So not sure what happened. Didn't watch the game, but it sounds like it was more Feyenoord being terrible and Man City being so good at exposing mistakes, as we've talked about before on here.
Absolutely. Pep did praise Kevin De Bruyne, though, as one of the best players he's ever seen. High praise indeed, but justified. Like most managers. It's not just Pep that does this. But, I mean, I think, remember, there was a period where Jose Mourinho would pick one of his players and say he's the best player in the world every year. But there are quite a few quotes of Pep picking this player and that as the best player ever.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier in the office. He's so hyperbolic. He's so hyperbolic.
Was it a 1-1 draw and he said it's the proudest performance of my career? Or
yeah, and he says, "I'm learning stuff from Raheem Sterling every day in training." Like, that might be true, but I think he's, because of the perception of him and his record as a manager, I think he really milks that for media interviews to make these pretty ridiculous claims, to be honest.
But even so, do you think he's justified, Kevin De Bruyne? I know we're all big fans of him here at Squawker. I think we were talking in the office earlier. I think it wasn't with you, actually. I think I was talking to Jay Entwistle about it. In some ways, he has everything Ozil has as like a technical and creative player, but he's got that physical kind of athleticism to go with it as well. He's a very complete all-rounder. We're seeing him play deeper now as well for Manchester City, and he's doing well. He picked all those passes in the win at the weekend as well. Do you think he's up there with the best Pep's coach? Obviously, he's not Messi, because Messi is the best coach, but he's up there, surely?
He's definitely City's best player. So by default, he kind of fits into that. But I think the thing with him is, would he get into Barcelona's best 11 under Pep? I don't know if he probably wouldn't get in that midfield
three.
He would
be in the weird bit that Cesc Fabregas was, where he's kind of too attacking
for Barcelona.
He'd be
like the 12th man, I think. He's great. I love watching him. He's really good. I'm still not convinced about this positioning of him in a sort of number six role. I'd prefer to see him higher up, to be honest. I think he's so good.
It definitely helped him
in around
down
the box.
To 10 men, definitely.
Yeah, because the first three games did nothing.
He's such a good finisher as well.
Yeah, his finishing is so crisp. And
you
kind of
want to take him away from that zone.
And his crossing, basically, the last two games, I mean, we're saying he's been better the last two games, but all of his assists have come from wide areas, and he's still been playing as a deep-lying playmaker. I'm still not sure that's his best position. But yeah, he's definitely City's best player. If he's one of Guardiola's best, and he thinks so, then why not? But he's still
why not?
He's still got a bit to go, to reach Xavi and Iniesta levels.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But City as a whole have probably got quite a challenge on their hands this weekend, away against Watford. We've all been very impressed by Marco Silva's work so far at Vicarage Road. And you look at where they're good and what they excel at. They're very good on the counter. They can be quite physical and combative in all areas of the park. We've heard Pep get very upset about the importance of the kind of second ball in English football, going for the 50-50. Those are the kind of things that Marco Silva has identified as kind of margins that Watford can gain on in the Premier League, and he did it the same at Hull as well. What are we expecting from this one, Ollie?
It's a really, really tough game for City to come back from a Champions League away game as well into, because Watford have been great this season. Silva's tightened them up massively. They've had three consecutive clean sheets, and going forward they look a lot better. You look through that Watford side, all right, they're not going to win the league or anything, but you know, there isn't a significant weakness there, I don't think. Everyone is really in tune to what they have to do. Silva showed in a very short space of time at Hull that he can organise a side both defensively and offensively, and he's had a whole pre-season at Watford to do that. He's bought very well, and they look a very good side. They could quite easily finish in the top 10 if they carry on like this. So it'll be tough for City, really tough.
We've seen De Bruyne play deeper, we've seen Danilo play deeper. You've got the quality of guys like Chalobah, Diakore, who have been really good in this kind of box-to-box role, Etienne Dupuy as well. Is that kind of the area where they could get at City, kind of pressing them at the back of their midfield?
I was going to say exactly, Dukure is the danger man, weirdly, for City. He's exactly the sort of player that...
For Watford.
Yeah, for Watford. He's exactly the sort of player that City are just like, oh no, don't do that. That's not part of the game. Is it? He's going to make Kevin De Bruyne's life a nightmare, and he's going to press into the space that he's going to leave. Full of energy, really direct player. I think Watford could cause them problems, but you'd expect City to beat Watford.
We saw West Brom struggle against Brighton last weekend with their kind of huge three-man hawking midfield of Kuchowiak, Gareth Barry, maybe less of a hook, and Jake Livermore. In some ways, Watford's midfield is like a more positive version of that, I'd say. They've might be going Pep Guardiola hyperbole style, but they've kind of got a bit of everything. They're really strong, they're really good at taking the ball past you, and they can actually keep hold of it as well.
Yeah, exactly. Chalobah's slotted in perfectly. Doucouré is an interesting one as well. I mean...
not many players like him.
No, but Matt Sarri didn't fancy him. Who was the manager before? Flores. Flores didn't fancy him either.
Sanchez, yeah.
And Silva's sort of brought him in from the cold and preferred him over Will Hughes, which I'm a little bit sad about because I was looking forward to seeing Will Hughes.
There's still time for Will Hughes.
But yeah.
But there's not much time left on this podcast. We're going to slide through the rest of the Champions League results. In Group B, Celtic were absolutely hammered 5-0 at home by PSG, that famous Parkhead atmosphere doing absolutely nothing for them. Neymar, Mbappe and Cavani all on the score sheet as they met expectations. Brendan Rodgers' side. Well, yeah, let's be honest.
They were so good, man.
They were so good. And Neymar getting into a bit of a kerfuffle with that 18-year-old
Ralston,
defender at the end.
Laughed in his face. He was just not being... Who basically hammered Thiago Motta in the knee, probably really trying to do him, and then decided to rile up the Celtic Park crowd after getting a yellow card.
I mean, that's what you do when you haven't won and you want to get, you know, some kind of... I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying you can totally see what he's trying to do there. They suffered a similar scoreline away against Barcelona last year. So the fact that they've just been absolutely hammered at home, probably not a great sign for their Champions League ambitions. Bayern, meanwhile, another team in the group which Celtic have to face at home and away, swept Anderlecht aside 3-0 amid talk of dissent against Ancelotti's methods following the post-Guardiola era. We're not following the post-Guardiola era. Not following the post-Guardiola era, we're in the post-Guardiola era, but there's a bit of talk that his kind of hands-off approach in training, it's not sitting well with some of the players that really like to, as Rafa Honigstein has put it, walk off the training ground with a headache because they've been given so many instructions previously.
Really odd, because players normally love Ancelotti because he's just the nicest guy. He lets you play positive football. But there's obviously, I think there's like a small corner of Guardiola footballers, guys like Kimmich, Thiago Alcantara, Alaba.
It might not be Kimmich because he's been quite critical.
But I can expect those players being like, I want to improve myself. I want to play for Pep Guardiola to improve myself. Whereas Ancelotti is like, you just do the best that you can and we'll win the Champions League.
Don't worry about that. But I mean, I have no idea who's saying this stuff, but you look at how these quotes have come out. I mean, Bayern can be quite a leaky club, but the way it's kind of come out seems kind of, you know, it's out there. I mean, Thomas Muller's playing really badly at the moment under Ancelotti, and he's come out and said that I play better in a team with a better system. So he's kind of, you know, low-key having a dig at how they're playing now. Ancelotti under a bit of pressure if the kind of wrong people at Bayern getting the wrong mindset on him?
Potentially. It was also telling in the Anderlecht game when Ribéry came off and chucked his shirt at the bench, which is, you don't really see things like that.
And yet you'd think he's the guy that would love Ancelotti because he didn't always have the best relationship with Guardiola either.
But then Ancelotti, he's a great manager and he wins everywhere he goes, but he's never really at a place longer than 2 or 3 years. I think at Milan he was there 7 years, and to be honest, they massively underachieved. I mean, we all remember them for having a great side.
Yeah.
But they won 2 Champions Leagues and 1 Serie A title in 7 years. So, maybe there is a question mark over Ancelotti for the first time in a while. But, I mean, he's got so much experience. He's been there and done that. He's won everything. And, I'm sure the sort of tide will turn in a few weeks.
They faced Mainz at the weekend, but last weekend they got beaten 2-0 by Hoffenheim, Julian Nagelsmann's Hoffenheim, which has kind of restarted this talk that he is the kind of promised one to take over and become the kind of homegrown Pep Guardiola to bring this kind of tactical intensity back to it. So that's one to look out for in the months, weeks, and maybe years ahead. Moving on now to Group D, Barcelona beat Juventus 3-0. Juve soundly beaten. Let's be fair to say. But they do tend to start seasons fairly slowly under Allegri and then build their kind of momentum up as it goes along. So maybe we shouldn't read too much into that, but Barcelona definitely have the advantage in the group stage now.
Yeah, I mean, that's the best I've seen Iniesta play in probably 2 years. He was incredible against Juventus. And I think Messi playing in that in the hole, as a lot of people have predicted for a few years, Valverde's finally taken the plunge and thought, do you know what? I'm going to take the risk. I'm going to play you deeper. Yeah. I think has really freed Iniesta quite a lot as well. It's really, really working for him. Because Messi works so hard off the ball as well. It's allowing Iniesta to sort of glide up and take his weird positions and make the key runs. But yeah, Messi and Iniesta were absolutely spectacular. So there's not much you can do against that. Even if you're Juve, you can't do much against that.
And I mean, Benfica maybe were expected to be the Europa League team in this group, but they've just been beaten at home by CSK Moscow. So, I mean, I think we can assume that Barcelona and Juventus are going to take the top two spots, aren't they? But maybe Benfica might lose out on getting into Europa League, which would be a bit of a shame considering their historical record in Europe. And, you know, everyone likes to see them do well just because of all that kind of prestige and all the rest of it. Over in Group G, Besiktas are currently top after a 3-1 win over Porto at home, while Monaco were held 1-1 away against Leipzig, the Red Bull back club getting their first ever point in Europe and probably the first of many.
Yeah, you'd think so. I mean, they weren't at their best. That was a really interesting tie because it's two sides sort of newcomers to the European scene and they're both going at it. Just on that group, though, I love this Besiktas side. It's like Football Manager 2008 dream team. They've got Pepe, Babel, all these kind of guys. And that was a really good result for them away to Porto. I'd like to see how they do. It's a really, actually, really balanced group, this. You know, a lot of all four clubs operate on similar budgets and similar quality as well. So literally any two could go through, I think, in that.
I like the idea of Besiktas as like a football Expendables.
Yeah, who else have they got? They've got Pepe, Ryan Babel, Negredo.
Is Medel there? Is he?
Yep, Gary Medel as well. Yeah, they've got a really like sort
they've
of
got them all.
Odd bunch of
Ace, the AC Milan of the new era.
Oh, the Super League.
AC Milan and Turkish football.
Sounds delightful. Going to move on now to the AC Milans of English football. We're really not. It's over onto the rest of the Premier League fixtures of note this weekend. I say of note, we're going to go through all of them. Friday night sees Bournemouth face Brighton. A relegation six-pointer on the south coast in September.
Yeah, well, this is huge for Bournemouth. They've lost their first four. And a dodgy result here could really pile the pressure on them because
if it wasn't Crystal Palace, that even more questions would be being asked of them, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and the thing is, they haven't really looked like scoring or even winning.
Their only goal was that Charlie
wonder goal,
wonder strike.
Yeah,
they didn't even look close to scoring against Arsenal, who have such a weak defense at the moment that's so short of confidence. They've got huge problems. They need to change. One of the big problems they've got at the moment is that Harry Arter's dip in form has come really at the worst time.
Yeah. And Das Gosling's offered nothing as well.
Dan Gosling's offered nothing. It really looks like, weirdly, they having someone like Wilshere was actually quite important for them last season. Someone who gets them into the final third.
They've got Lewis Cook. Why are they not using him?
Yeah.
They can't get into the final third, Bournemouth. We've been talking about this a lot recently.
But they've got Lewis Cook.
Yeah, but
he's on the fantasy bench. Why is he not playing?
I don't know, but they just, against, this was the problem. Defoe looked so starved of the ball. He had one chance against Arsenal and he hit the post. You get in the ball a bit more.
Well, Hush Karai was saying this, actually, because we were on shift during that match against Arsenal. Defoe, the way that Sunderland set up to make the most of Defoe is the complete opposite of how Bournemouth play. So is it any surprise that it's not quite clicking at the moment?
Everyone has been saying this. Every time I look at Twitter when there was the Defoe deal announced, everyone was saying, you're overpaying for a striker who's too reliant on penalty goals and he won't fit into the system.
I mean, the only time he got that shot is actually when Gashoni was still hobbling because his leg had just gone.
Yeah, and it was a cross, which Bournemouth don't do very often. Like, it's not the right team. Just because he used to play there and he happens to be in form.
It's
a sentimental move. They'd never work out.
We talked earlier about Harry Kane and Lukaku and like how these are top things. This might sound outlandish. I'm pretty sure I said it before on the podcast and people laughed at me, but anyway, Callum Wilson, they miss him so much. He is basically like a Football League version of Robert Lewandowski. He does hold up play fantastically well. He's basically everything for them. I haven't actually seen... Okay, and Josh King was doing his random hat-trick.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say.
That was good, but they are such a better side with Callum Wilson up there, and I don't know what's up with him now. He's got a serious injury, hasn't he, or something?
He's had two serious knee injuries in 2 years.
Real shame for Bournemouth, really.
Yeah, it's going to be tough for him to rediscover that level. But yeah, Josh King was brilliant last year. 14 goals for a club like Bournemouth in the Premier League is absolutely insane. I think 11 of those are after January as well. So the Defoe deal was just a little bit weird when they had a free scoring striker anyway.
Moving on now to Saturday. And Crystal Palace versus Southampton, Roy Hodgson's debut. Oof, Croydon through and through. Southampton in no great shakes either, though, against the Eagles. Another two sides set to struggle. I mean, Zaha is out for Palace, so it's kind of understandable why they're lacking a bit. But what's missing for Saints?
I mean, they're profligate, really.
Yeah.
They waste chances. They did last year. I think the best thing that they can hope for is that Gabbiadini finds some of that form that he had before his injury last season. If they can get someone who's really good at putting the ball in the back of the net, then that will be a huge help for them, because Austin and Long are so streaky. Long doesn't score any goals. He's just quick and really good at pressing. But Gabbiadini getting goals, they really need that, because the rest of the team's clicking quite well.
If Austin wasn't made out of glass, maybe they'd be doing better. Huddersfield take on Leicester City after being shown up away at West Ham, as West Ham finally showed that they're a football team. can the Terriers prove themselves worthy of their billing as like the side to beat relegation against the Foxes this weekend?
I was a little bit disappointed with them on Monday because they just seemed to...
They didn't offer anything, did they?
They gave West Ham so much respect, which is bizarre because West Ham have been dreadful this season. Mm. They kind of just sat back and it looked like they were playing for a 0-0 from the start, which was a little bit weird considering how they went to Palace and were really, they really went for it. And West Ham were in a similar position to Palace and they kind of just backed off them. Back at home, you'd expect them to give it more of a go, but... Leicester need to win as well, really. They've lost three games, despite sort of playing a lot better than they did last year. They're not picking up points. So, this is the kind of game for Leicester that they really need to get a win. And Huddersfield have got a bit of a tough ask, I think.
Absolutely. Newcastle United host Stoke City. Even though they've had their problems, I'd probably say they're two evenly matched sides with similar ambitions of a kind of a steady mid-table finish, would you say, Nick? And you know, will Hughes shake Rafa's hand if he's fit enough to sit on the bench, maybe?
I think they've got very different ambitions. I think Stoke, you know, they want to finish 10th or 9th.
But don't Newcastle fans really?
Yeah, of course Newcastle fans want to finish there, but, you know, be realistic. Look at your squads.
They need to avoid relegation.
They need to avoid relegation. Yeah. Like, focus on avoiding relegation. I can see...
I mean, it's Joselu's,
I keep
he's
writing,
back.
Yeah, Joselu's back. I keep writing off Stoke, and they keep playing actually quite well. Yeah, so I think I need to reevaluate. But I'm worried that if they're going to play really badly, and I'm going to be like, ah, I told you so.
gotcha.
Choupo-Moting's a bit of an unusual player, but again, it's another.
He's so inconsistent.
Yeah, exactly. It's another really inconsistent player. Stoke are just a team full of really inconsistent players.
So maybe the focus will be on Mikel Merino for Newcastle because he seems to be, you know, getting into his stride really now.
Yeah, he's been good, but Newcastle sort of toiled a little bit against Swansea and then got a set piece goal from Lascelles. Lascelles is great, actually.
Yeah,
he's their best player.
He's a big lad.
He is. He's absolute massive, and yeah, he's class. But Stoke's recruitment, I think, has actually gone on the radar a little bit. Most of the summer, we were kind of thinking, oh,
it's because they signed about 7 centre backs.
Yeah, we're like, why aren't they signing anyone? They signed that sort of 18-year-old kid with that really annoying Twitter video thing.
I wrote off Zuma so hard.
But yeah, Zuma's been great. Hesse's been great.
Yeah, but
Choupo-Moting's getting goals.
What they've done is, I was worried about Zuma and Shawcross as a partnership, but they've just dropped Shawcross, despite the fact they gave him a new 4-year deal. And that's worked really, really well for the defence because he's been in a very bad patch of form.
Speaking of defences and speaking of bad patches of form, West Brom host West Ham in a battle of the West. for the West.
Brom
the
versus
West.
Ham.
Yeah, Brom versus Ham. Yeah, I mean, West Brom are going to put Brighton behind them and just squash West Ham, aren't they?
Well, we said this last week.
Tony Pulis turned to Brighton and went, we won't bother attacking. We'll defend so well that I don't really get what he's trying to do there.
Yeah, it's a bit odd, but I think we can put that down as a blip and maybe a bit of squad adjustment.
Tony Pugh blip.
Yes. don't say that out loud too many times.
No.
But yeah, West Ham are, you know, to use a Tony Gale-ism, they're at sixes at sevens at the back, midfield, and up front. So I think a team as organised as West Brom that can, you know, put the ball into dangerous areas with the weapons that they have. Salomon Rondon is way overdue a goal or three. So.
Or a
decent game. I can see West Brom doing a bit of damage here because West Ham are really, they've got so many problems across that 11.
They're going to come in like a wrecking ball.
Yeah,
the ball's going to be in the air the whole time.
Oh my God, yeah.
Andy Carroll's back in.
Oh wow, yeah.
I mean, Monday night, West Ham, they needed to get a win from somewhere and they literally just pumped the ball forward to Andy Carroll and sort of hoped for the best. And I think this weekend is literally just going to be back and forth.
Oh, it's going to be disgusting.
How long is it going to be until Tony Pulis is able to put in a £50 million bid for Andy Carroll?
Quite a long time, because it's West Brom.
I think January. Let's see it. I can't wait for it.
But... Rondon and Carroll up front.
Exactly. And that sounds like the kind of forward that would thrive in the Championship, which is where we're going now. Sorry, Championship fans, I know it's a very sophisticated league and they play lots of wonderful attacking football. I take it all back. But midweek fixtures saw Leeds move top and become the top scorers in the division so far after beating Birmingham 2-0. They face Millwall away, a meaty fixture this weekend. But elsewhere, Brentford host Reading, Middlesbrough versus QPR, Hull versus Sunderland, Forest versus Wolves, Cardiff versus Sheffield Wednesday. Lots of intriguing ties. How might the league table look come Sunday morning?
Well, hopefully Leeds are still top, because the excitement around Leeds being top, you've never seen. Like, Leeds fans are suddenly, like, emerging from, you know, pub cellars.
And can do it playing well.
They're like, they've seen the sunshine for the first time. They're playing brilliantly.
Yeah.
They're really, really doing well. I mean, genuinely exciting. And I think a lot of football fans around the UK want to see Leeds back in the Premier League. It kind of feels like that's where they belong. I know we talk about there's big clubs in the Championship.
They've been to a European Cup final.
Yeah, we talk about big clubs in the Championship, but Leeds are a massive club. And
Leeds, the city, is the biggest city in the UK without a Premier League club.
Yeah, exactly. And
that's facts.
Realistically, it's the only club in the city as well. They're an institution. So to not have them in the Premier League is a bit weird. So hopefully they keep that up. Elsewhere, I mean, Cardiff have started brilliantly as well. So could see them.
And Sheffield Wednesday, as I think you said in the last podcast, they're a bit of an
outfit. Two wins in a row now.
Yeah.
So they're sort of gradually finding their form again.
Mm. 100%. We're going to move now to all the action around Europe and pick out a fixture from each of the leagues to focus in on. Starting off in Spain, in La Liga, Real Sociedad versus Real Madrid. Ronaldo is still suspended, but La Real, top scorer with 10 goals so far this season. As Anyana's eyes there now, there's lots of interesting football being played in San Sebastian. Could be a good game.
Yeah, very good game. Sociedad have started absolutely brilliantly, and it's the sort of team that can cause Real Madrid some problems. They play with a lot of people in the middle, so the middle area of the final third, which is, you know, one of Real Madrid's possibly weaker spots in the squad.
Well, then they're not just missing Ronaldo either. I think Benzema's not going to be fit for this either, is he? So there's outages.
There's a huge opportunity, and Real Madrid haven't made the best start to La Liga as well, so they won't want to lose too much more ground, especially without being able to call upon Ronaldo, like in the 70th minute, just to come on and just get a goal out of nothing. So, definitely want to keep an eye on that.
Absolutely. Over in the Bundesliga, Dortmund host Cologne. Both sides in action in Europe this week. But, I mean, this is going to be one where Dortmund take hold, surely, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, though. I mean, last week, Dortmund played Freiburg and passed them off the park, but couldn't score. It was 0-0. They had similar problems against Spurs, as we mentioned earlier. They didn't really create an awful lot. So Cologne, the game plan for them is just sit deep. Hopefully counter on them and see what happens. But Dortmund, you'd expect to sort of snap out of two poor results and get back to winning ways.
Mm-hmm. Over in Serie A, in Italy, there's no real heavyweight clashes, and without any disrespect to the teams I'm about to mention, in the league this weekend. But Torino are taking on Sampdoria in what I think could be quite a nicely balanced contest. And obviously, you've got Torino's really exciting front three to watch as well. So could be one to catch.
Yeah, Sampdoria have got a lot of nice players as well. Mm. Nice players. That's a terrible, terrible
lovely
phrase.
Lovely, nice
just,
players.
Just lovely chaps.
There's they a lot of technicians in there.
Technicians.
They've actually got their recruitment spot on recently. They've been signing a lot of young players for cheap fees and then selling
them off.
They're
trying to get massively. That younger Jack Wilshere, weren't they?
Yeah, well, they sold Fernandez to Sporting. We saw what he could do in the Champions League. They sold Schick as well. Mm. But they seem to be getting it right when it comes to buying young talent from all over the place. So they're an exciting side to watch. And Belotti's banging goals in again this season. So
what he does. It's what he does, isn't it? Yeah. It's what he does. Over in France, in Ligue 1, or as we like to call it, Neymar Land. PSG take on Lyon. So many dribbles on one pitch, Nick.
So many dribbles on one pitch. I mean, if it wasn't, it's only two games in, but Mbappe has added even another level to that PSG attack. Oh my God.
Like a double Cavani.
Ugh. Just
and Cavani is actually clinical at the moment.
That goal, that run in the header.
PSG are pure filth. Lyon are a bit shaky at the moment because, you know, they've lost their two best players over the summer.
But even if it's not an evenly matched match, I just think the amount of skill on show is just going to be worth tuning in.
There's going to be a lot of goals because, what's it? Bertrand Traoré and who's the other one? Mariano,
yeah.
Who they brought in to replace Lacazette, have both sort of hit the ground running as well. Mm-hmm. Lyon Bordeaux a few weeks ago, it was 3-3. It was the most ridiculous game I think I've ever seen. So Lyon are fun to watch. PSG are obviously fun to watch, so it should be a good one.
But yes. Lyon had the most through balls in Europe's top five leagues last season. Okay, they've lost Talisso and many other players, but still. Yeah. Still.
PSG have got, they're obviously going for another statement season. That was the second season after the Qatari owners took over.
It's the Empire Strikes Back, isn't it?
Yeah, they're
building the second Death Star.
They want to crush every team in the league. You can see that when they step on the pitch. Emery's obviously been told just crush them. So it should be awesome to watch. As Ollie says, there should be loads of goals.
Loads and loads and loads of goals. Hopefully there'll be loads of goals in the Premier League as well, because there's quite a few last weekend as well. But that's all we've got time for today on the Squawker Talker. It's not just the return of the Champions League, though. That's a bit of a momentous thing this week. I say that, momentous, but yeah, whatever. I'm not going to be the host of the Squawker Talker for much longer.
No,
as in,
not.
This is my last episode. It's
Greg's last
devastating.
Ever. Devastating blow.
What are we going to do?
Yeah. It's just going to be me and Ollie talking at an empty chair for an hour and a half.
And Ben Davis, yes, me too.
And no one to stop us from talking.
Well, I'm not too good at the stopping talking thing. We do regularly overrun, which I'm sure.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Value for megabytes or something. Yeah.
In case listeners are worried, you shouldn't be, because I'm going to be taking over hosting duties in the interim.
And just obviously, listen to that voice.
Yeah. Oh. It's never going to be as good as Greg, though, obviously, who's done a fantastic job. But feel free to tune in on Mondays and Fridays as usual. We will still be doing the Squawker Talker. We'll still have the regular guests. We'll have Ollie. Ollie's going to be around. We'll have Mohamed Butt. Obviously, we're getting James Benj back involved a bit more because he's been a bit away and we've not been good at picking up the phone. Carl Anker's going to be in.
Sounds like he sent you a letter.
So all your regulars are still they're still going to be around. It's just going to be a little less northern.
Yeah, a little less northern.
A little less northern.
A little less northern. But oh well. These things happen. If you are mad for the whole kind of, you know, consistency thing, though, defending numbers is still going, and there's no change there. It's back with you every Thursday, and as I've said earlier on the podcast, do check it out. It's on iTunes, it's on Deezer, it's on all your usual major podcast providers, so do check that out. It's been wonderful. Thank you for all your questions and listening for, well, we've done like over 130 episodes now, haven't we? So it's been it's been a while, so thanks for that. Ollie, thank you for joining us.
Cheers, Greg.
Nick, thank you for coming on.
No, thank you, Greg.
And listeners, thank you very much, and see you soon.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.